going to hear now from Dr. Danny Kleinfelter from Texas A&M University, and he's a professor and extension economist with Texas AgriLife Extension and Texas A&M. He's director of something called the Executive Program for Agricultural Producers, TPAP, and co-director of the Texas A&M Family and Owner Managed Business Program, and has been involved with the development and management of an exceptional farm management training program there. And he serves as the executive secretary for the Association of Agriculture Production Executives. We felt strongly enough about having Dr. Kleinfelter come and talk to us about some of the principles that producers can apply in a more broader sense, that even though he wasn't available this morning, we've recorded his presentation for you, which we're going to run here in just a second. You can still submit your questions. We've submitted some questions for him. We'll get him to respond to those and let you all know when he's posted his responses. But he's one of the best down at the farm level, management strategies, things that producers ought to be thinking about. So,
all right, well, good morning, everyone. We're going to be talking about managing volatility in agriculture. Dan Sumner started off with where we are. I'm going to talk to you in more of an introductory fashion about where we want to go and how do we get there, and then we'll lead into the more in-depth seminars or webinars following this one. Let's start off. A couple of things I've noted is I think too many producers treat input and output pricing as totally unrelated issues. And because volatility affects both sides of the equation, if you fix prices on one side without simultaneously addressing those on the other, it actually can exacerbate the problems. I think one of the best examples I've seen recently was in 2008 when Midwest corn farmers were afraid fertilizer prices were going to blow on through $1,000. Locked in fertilizer at $800 or $1,000 a ton, bid up cash rents, and didn't price their corn until the fall. And by the time the fall came around, both fertilizer prices and corn prices had come down significantly. But they'd already locked in their fertilizer rent, and it turned what could have been a very favorable situation into a pretty bad one. The basic point is, I've heard people talk about, well, I'm trying to manage my margins, where they lock in one side based on what they think the other side of the equation is going to do. That's not managing margin. It's just pure speculation. Let's turn to the next slide. One of the points I think we ought to remember when we're beginning this, most people think about risk management as minimizing the downside risk. One of the things volatility does, it also creates some very strong upside opportunities at times. I think your risk management strategy needs to focus on not eliminating the upside opportunity. What that likely means, at least in my mind, is that we're probably going to see greater use of options and insurance. The premium or transaction cost is higher than straight hedging or cash forward contracting, but it leaves the possibility to capture the upside. One of the big things about any risk management strategy is a big part of it is having the capacity to deal with change. One of the things I see people do, not just ag producers, but small businessmen and others, is they're so focused on being least cost that they limit their business's ability to adapt. I mean, it's like, let's be lean and mean, or the old notion, the British saying, penny wise and pound foolish. And you can look at some examples. You know, limiting staffing. I think it's really critical that there be some additional slack capabilities in terms of management skill sets, the capacity of the management team to adapt, and the bench strength. If you're operating on a bare bones management team, you're limited in your ability to adjust. The other is from a couple of things on the financial side. In a highly volatile environment, working capital becomes king. The ability to absorb a shock and still play the game. It used to be, primary measure of working capital was the current assets to current liabilities. Over the last 20 years, we've learned that working capital or net working capital to gross revenue is probably a better measure. Initially, the general rule of thumb was you want 25 to 30% of gross revenue in the form of net working capital at year end. As it becomes more volatile, that ratchets up. 40 to 50% is probably more reasonable, and particularly if you fix things like cash rent or have a fairly high level of fixed debt service commitments. In terms of debt structure, there's been a real strong incentive lately to go short term because the rates are so much cheaper. At the same time, what that means is if interest rates move suddenly, and they haven't been lately, you could have locked yourself into a little real liquidity problem. I think it's important for producers to examine whether or not paying a slight premium to fix rates for a longer term. Think of it as an insurance premium, not just trying to get the low dollar every time. Leverage, same way. When land values have been going up lately, we've had pretty good profitability. There's been a tendency for some producers to push themselves out toward the edge and lever themselves up. I think you need to look at your situation and say, could I stand a 20 to 30% asset value shock? That is, land values, machinery, equipment, cattle prices, anything else. That doesn't appear to be on the near term, but do you have the ability to absorb that kind of hit? Capital debt repayment capacity, basically what we're looking at is net farm income plus non-farm income, adding back interest and depreciation, relative to those committed term debt principal and interest payments. What's your coverage? Used to be we want to see 1.25 to 1. More and more I'm seeing lenders that would like to see that 1.5 to 1 in a highly volatile environment. The other thing, farmers traditionally, and for tax reasons, ease of computation, everything else, have obviously used cash basis income. I think it's critical that more and more people not change their basis for tax payment, but calculate accrual adjusted net income. There have been all kinds of studies and all kinds of examples which show there can be a 2-year lag in cash basis income recognizing problems are occurring that would have been reflected in accrual adjusted accounting. And that's simply too late to make the necessary corrections. In terms of contracts, depends on where you are in the country. But obviously, if you're in a fixed cash rent area, the possibility of trying to negotiate either share rents, go to flex rents, or cash rents with bonus or disaster clauses, I think there's some way to see if you can get the landlord to, again, he has the upside, greater upside potential, but to share at least on some limited basis the downside risk. Over the past 25 or 30 years, I've had the opportunity to work with some of the best farm and ranch managers in the country. One of the things I've observed is if you're looking at producers in terms of profitability, the biggest difference I see between the top 10% of producers in profitability and the rest, not of the population, but the rest of the top 25%, has primarily been timing. That is, when they get in, when they expand, when they cut back, when they get out. And I don't care if it's on investments, on commodity marketing, on redeploying capital, that is where you harvest your wins, cut your losses, reallocate funding. That moving before the herd just makes a tremendous difference. And just being a little bit ahead of the herd all the time. Let's look at the next slide. My points are this, that there are two issues involved. One, you've got to have risk management strategy and tools in place to deal with those things that you can't anticipate, the timing exactly. But the second one, and I don't think we do enough of this in agriculture, there's an awful lot of focus on the local situation or a specific commodity or what's happening in the U.S. I think we need to be looking a lot more at trying to identify leading indicators. Success is a relative thing. It's not some absolute. I mean, your trying to do better than your competition, to stay in the front half of the herd. In the future, those who are going to be successful will almost always be those who see the possibilities, that is, either problems or opportunities, before they become obvious to the typical producer. And as markets have become more global, macroeconomic indicators need to be part of your tool chest. For example, looking at things like political shifts, and I don't mean just in the U.S. Look what's happened in the EU. China, where protectionism is starting to creep in, or people are managing the value of their currency to try to encourage exports, or there are these additional regulatory burdens coming on. Those are all things that we need to recognize and have a major play on what the markets are going to do. Monetary policy, whether it's inflation, interest rates, I think a big one is exchange rates. And a lot of times there's a tendency to look at just the exchange rate of the U.S. dollar relative to the country currency that we're selling to. My point is that you need to look at the exchange rate not just of the dollar versus a potential customer, but the exchange rate of the dollar relative to competing countries. For example, if we're competing in China with grains with Argentina, Australia, Brazil, we need to look at our relative exchange rates to those countries, as well as how many Chinese units of Chinese currency we can buy. Global weather conditions play into it. Look at this winter or this summer's and fall's wheat prices. A big part of that was two things. One, the drought in the Eastern Bloc, and the fires in Russia, but also the fact that later on the corn crop was off here in the U.S., since in much of the rest of the world, wheat is a feed crop. You need to be looking at weather conditions at a minimum at the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, plus Argentina and Australia and Canada. Standard things such as commodity stocks and carryover use ratios, energy prices. What's the outlook for those? What's happening? Fact is, about 70% of ag operating expenses are directly or indirectly related to energy costs in this country. One of the things I think we get so focused on looking at our own businesses, when you're thinking about managing risk and looking at the impact of volatility, you need to be thinking about not just the direct effect on your own business, but what's volatility doing to your suppliers, to your buyers, to employees, family members, and to your lenders? One of the things that we've already seen, and it's been happening over about the last 3 years, is as risk gets priced into or pushed up or down the supply chain, risk management is going to be increasingly important to those parts of the supply chain with the least market power. And what that tends to be is the open market commodity producer. Just for example, fertilizer dealers that got caught with a lot of unpriced, very high dollar inventory in 2008 simply aren't doing that anymore. Their lender isn't going to finance it. They're not going to be able or willing to stock inventory unless it's been pre-priced. That's a different set of conditions that existed prior to that time. Elevators, when they got the extreme margin calls in 2008, it isn't just their risk management internally that's going to be an issue. Many of their lenders are limiting either the dollar line of credit they can have to handle margin calls or the number of contracts they can enter into. You get to your lenders. Most of you have probably seen, in terms of interest rate risk management by the lender, that their ability to match funds has meant they're pushing people to shorter repricing terms or charging a pretty good premium if you want to try to go out very far in fixing rates. One of the other things, this is on the aside, you need to think about, I think, is with your lenders, do they really understand and they're agreeing to and committed to whatever risk management strategy you decide to pursue. You need to understand it. They need to understand it. The worst thing that could happen is to get halfway into the year and be positioned somewhere and have your lender get nervous and pull the rug. It's a communication and education issue on both sides. The other thing I'm seeing more push by lenders as well as some farmers is greater use of FSA guarantees. Now, there's a lot of stigma associated with it. People still remember back to the 80s. Well, if you need an FSA guarantee, that means you're in trouble. The reality is that isn't necessarily true. FSA can also be a source of opportunity because an FSA guarantee, at least on enough to cover your margin line, for example, gives your lender a lot greater flexibility. He doesn't have to capitalize that part of the line as heavily. He gets less regulatory pressure from his examiners, and he has less loss exposure. You want the situation where he can be flexible, or if you have an adverse set of circumstances, that he's more likely to stay with you that other year or do any restructuring. There's another thing that has come up, in fact, is CoBank. When they used to talk about, everybody talked about the five C's of credit, has added a sixth C, in addition to character, capacity, capital, and other things, and conditions, among others. One of the sixth C, is counterparty risk. That is, what risk do you face from the other side of any contractual arrangements you're in, not performing on their end of the contract? If you pre-purchase fertilizer, what happens if something goes down with your fertilizer dealer? If you forward contracted with an ethanol plant or with a grain dealer and something happens to them before the contract is finally consummated in terms of delivery, what happens to you? If you have a receivable, what's it mean? And I think some of the things people are going to have to look at as means of trying to mitigate those risks are things like bonded warehouse receipts and make sure you know what that bond covers. Potentially letters of credit from a supplier or from a buyer guaranteeing performance. Third-party guarantees in some cases. Paying a fee if it's a large enough deal for independent verification and financial assessment of the other party to any agreement you're in. I mean, most of us don't have the ability or access to the information on our suppliers and buyers to really be able to tell what kind of financial condition they're in. There are independent parties out there that have the ability to do that assessment. And if you've got enough receivables, there in fact are forms of receivable insurance. They're fairly expensive and they're not available on all types of receivables, but it's been used a lot outside of agriculture. All right, let's wrap up with 5 points I think you need to think about from just a pure business management standpoint in terms of managing these risks that are being accentuated because of increased volatility. The first is making sure you're doing what-if and sensitivity analysis. And all I'm saying here, you need to be thinking about what could happen, good or bad, and what would you do if it did beforehand? The idea of waiting until you're right in the middle of the problem and it hits you and then trying to decide, you've reduced the amount, the time you have to react. You've reduced the number of options you have available to you to mitigate the risk. And there's also a greater chance you're going to be dealing emotionally instead of rationally. Doing sensitivity analysis, you know, how much can you stand to lose? How much of an impact would a 10%, 20%, or 25% change have? I mean, when grain prices fell by 50% or went up by 100%, or the same with fertilizer. We used to look at these 10, 20% changes. That may not reflect the amount of volatility we're seeing in the market. And the idea of just sticking our head in the sands and using the ostrich syndrome isn't the way to deal with it. It's just like a general or a good coach in terms of scrimmaging or developing a game plan. The second one is monitoring and analysis. And basically what I mean here in terms of monitoring is staying on top of things. looking at your budget or your plan versus what's actually happening, what kind of variations. As the year goes along, have the assumptions you base that plan on changed? And if they have, should you modify the plan for the rest of the year? It's all about timing, being able to capitalize on opportunities or address problems before they get to be too big. The analysis simply means going that extra step to drill far enough down through the information to identify the cause. Awful lot of people react to symptoms of problems and never address or figure out what the actual cause is. The third one I'd encourage is what I call decision autopsies. Some people call these debriefings. But basically, it's sitting down and looking at the results of key decisions, whether they went well or they went poorly. Basically, where were the errors in the assumptions we made? Are there biases that appear to be coming into the way we're developing our plans? Were there mid-course corrections that we could and should have made? What did we learn from the process? One of the things I find a lot of people have a bad year, and the obvious answer is, well, commodity prices were down or input costs were up. For the year as a whole, that may be true, but were there periods of time when you had the opportunity to take advantage of actually higher commodity prices or lower input costs? The fact that the overall market may be down over the year or at the end of the year doesn't mean always that there was no opportunity during the year. And that's the staying on top of things and moving when the opportunity presents itself. Another thing I'd encourage more of you to do is look at the opportunity to create peer advisory groups. That is, by invitation only, putting together a group of top CEOs that you can use as a sounding board. In effect, you're each acting as each other's advisory board, where you develop enough trust in sharing information to look at best practices, to get, as I said, a sounding board for your ideas, to get some different perspectives. We all tend to look at things through basically a filter, and you don't want your filter to be too narrow. The other is to benchmark your performance, and I don't mean just financial or production performance. Benchmark your marketing performance. Benchmark your cost of production. Other things of that nature. And lastly, I think we're seeing a lot more of this, and we're going to more in the future, are pooling arrangements and alliances. What you're trying to do is, are there ways you could capture economies of scale, improve asset utilization, or find a way to employ or afford greater levels of technical expertise? Now, when people hear of pooling arrangements, generally they're talking about aggregating your buying power or selling power. But it can also be to take additional steps by going together in the value chain or employing in the area of, let's say, cost accounting or risk management, a level of expertise that would be too expensive for any individual firm. But forming an LLC and employing that level of expertise, which the group shares in the cost of but also shares in the group benefit of, I think has some real opportunities. We're going to get into some more things and much more depth related to grain marketing, livestock marketing, fruits and vegetables in the next seminars, looking at decision aids and tools. But I hope we've kind of framed some of the things you need to be thinking about other than just how do I mitigate my risk on the downside. All right, with that, I'm going to turn it back to our MC.
The first one, you know, I know you've done a lot of work with the top producer groups and stuff like that, and you mentioned this that a top 10%. Is there some kind of a distinguishing characteristic that you see in those folks so that they're ahead of the game and are doing the kinds of things that you suggest?
There's three things. One of them is the staying on top of what's going on. Most producers, I think, look at planning as a beginning and analysis as a beginning and end of the year exercise, and then that's something they had to do for their lender for tax purposes, and then they put that aside and they do the job. These guys I've seen much more likely, and usually it's because they've got additional resources available to them or have decided to pay for the additional resources, have people, like I said, plan versus actual, practically on a daily basis, and not just what's happening in terms of historically what's occurred to this point versus what I planned, but have the basis for my assumptions changed so that I can make adjustments, and I think that's a big part of it. The other is just a bias toward action. There's an awful lot of people that tend to procrastinate. Well, I don't know if that now at the time. When these guys see an opportunity or a problem, they move would be a second thing that I see a lot of. One other thing I forgot to mention, and this is becoming even more important, and I've mentioned it several times, but this idea of developing leading indicators, it doesn't help with probably the 1 day, 2 week timing, but the idea of shifts occurring that have major changes in the way the tide's flowing. There's a lot of people, it seems to me, are continuing to swim upstream when the current has shifted.
The second one is, again, this is kind of a broad category question, but in your assessment, in speaking to volatility, you've mentioned both upside and downside potential. What's your assessment of the actual upside and downside potential? I mean, if you could give a percentage of or a relative index of the potential in those things, how would they compare? Is it equal on the upside, or is the downside twice as great as the upside? What's your potential for the next short term, 3 to 5 years?
From a survival standpoint, there's probably more problem on the downside, because you can miss some opportunities and still be around to play the game. You get hammered on the downside, you may be out of business. But in terms of just the way the markets have moved, I don't know that there's much evidence that it's a normal distribution. But at the same time, I think if it isn't 50-50, it's probably 60-40. I think there's some significant upside opportunities that we've been missing, and that producers miss in part because they're so afraid of what the adverse outcome could be that they've locked themselves into a position. That's, I guess, why I was saying, I think even though it means higher transaction cost and premiums, that insurance options as opposed to straight hedging or straight cash contracting can give you the opportunity to catch that. It's going to raise your costs some. But if you factor those costs into your break-even cost when you're developing your marketing plan, it will also leave the upside open too.